Disability comes in many forms. It can also depend on context. Kim Nelson, in her book, A Disability History of the United States, tells of being at a conference in Montreal with a colleague who is blind. She writes that waiters and cabbies were always looking to me to take the lead. But I don't speak French. Luckily, my colleague is fluent in French. In that context, my linguistic deficiencies became far more of an impediment, far more of a disability than her blindness. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 changed the context of our country for the better for many people with disabilities, an estimated 20% of our country today, although much work remains to be done. Growing up, I didn't think much about disabilities, primarily because I didn't think I had to. In contrast, my wife Megan's mother was born with type 1 diabetes, which had an increasingly debilitating, disabling effect on her health and eventually led to her death when Megan and her twin sister were 21. And for the 80% of Americans who currently do not have a disability, none of us knows what the future holds. To give just one example, my sophomore year in college, my friend Greg, who lived a few doors down from me in the dorms, was with a group of four of our other friends, and they were driving downtown to a cafe, a trip that we had made hundreds of times, when another driver ran a red light. Four of the five escaped with minor abrasions, as did the other driver. But Greg was thrown through the front windshield, leaving him legally blind, partially deaf, and in a wheelchair. Not long after that accident, I read the political philosopher John Rawls's landmark book, A Theory of Justice. In that book, Rawls invites us to think through what it means to seek justice. Now, that book is slightly controversial. A lot of people have written criticisms of it, but they're all writing criticisms of Rawls, and that's because he's sort of the elephant in the room in thinking through these modern theories of justice in an enlightened society. So one of his core ideas in thinking about what does it mean to seek justice, and the idea that stuck with me the most, is that, especially in the wake of Greg's accident, is a thought experiment in which you're invited to imagine you're behind a veil of ignorance regarding the advantages and disadvantages that you will be born with. Imagine that no one knows their place in society, their class position, their social status, nor does anyone know their fortune in the distribution of natural assets and abilities, intelligence, strength, and the like. The principles of justice are chosen in Rawls's thought experiment behind such a veil of ignorance. How would you construct society if you didn't know what your position and advantages and disadvantages would be in it? Rawls assumes that most people in such a hypothetical original position would choose to structure society in such a way that even the most vulnerable among us would have their basic needs met. Because in that thought experiment, that could be you. That could be your child, your loved one. Rawls's theory of justice challenges us that we should fight for the same accommodation and dignity for others that we would want if we were in their situation. Along those lines, the argument could be made that the wheelchair ramp here at the sanctuary, and I've heard this from people, is not, I'm not going to call anybody out, but that it's not the most aesthetically pleasing picture. Though if you were mobility impaired, it could be to you one of the most beautiful features of our sanctuary. And although houses of worship are excluded from ADA accommodation requirements, many religious communities, including this one, hold accessibility as a core commitment. Some of you who have been part of UUCF since the 1970s may remember that on a Sunday morning, many years before this building was built in 2003, we rented space as a congregation for the 50-plus years we've been in existence. And on that Sunday, an invited minister came to speak, and no one knew in advance, but that minister was in a wheelchair. But the meeting room that was being rented at that time was not accessible. So to go on with worship this morning, they had to carry him downstairs and then back upstairs again. And that awkwardness, that embarrassment about not having an accessible meeting room has increased the awareness of many members of this congregation as to the importance of meeting in space that is as accessible as possible to all. To give you just a few more examples, in dialoguing with disability rights activists, one of the ways I've been challenged is to become more aware of what is called ableist language. And the idea is less to become just super politically correct than to just become more aware of how the world can look differently and how language can sound differently when depending on one's situation in life. And the ways in which our language has evolved, in particular, to have negative associations associated with disabilities and positive associations for abilities. For example, using the phrase, "that's lame," to express derision sounds differently if one is unable to walk. Even if not intended to be offensive, as the saying goes, intent doesn't equal impact. Here's a more complicated example. This past December, the Unitarian Universalist Association posted a holiday image on its Facebook page that said, "We already possess," and think about that word "we." I think we can presume "we" too quickly sometimes, and people are like, "I'm not in the we that you're talking about." So they posted a holiday image that said, "We already possess all the gifts that we need. We've already received our presence, ears to hear music, eyes to behold lights, hands to build true peace on earth, and to hold each other tight in love." And in an increasingly commercialized holiday season in which too many people go into debt, you know, Jesus didn't come to be the patron saint of fourth quarter profits, right? That's a separate sermon, but just trust me on that. So in a commercialized, overly commercialized holiday season, the message's intent was arguably a good one, to increase people's gratitude for simple gifts and simple pleasures, listening to music, seeing beautiful sights, the ability to extend a helping hand to those in need. But some people were offended at the perception of ableist language that seemed oblivious, that some people don't have those gifts and presence, that they don't have eyes to see, ears to hear, or necessarily hands to extend. To give just one more complex example, there are also critics of the UUA's Standing on the Side of Love campaign, which is for standing on the side of immigration justice, standing on the side of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender justice. It's been an incredibly effective campaign. It's been an incredibly important campaign. But people have also pointed out that do we have to say standing on the side of love for those? Now, that slogan can also be understood in the sense of taking a stand, right? And I think important suggestions and some graphics have even been made with standing on the side of love and then having some people standing, some people in wheelchairs, so having different ways of expressing that. So it's not that we can't get past it. And at our best, we must seek to balance an increasing sensitivity to difference with the need to express ourselves with imperfect language, finite language and perception. And in the words of one of my UU minister colleagues, if our mission is perfection, we are doomed to fail. Instead, she writes, "I believe our mission is to love the hell out of the world." And what she's referencing there is that we're Unitarian Universalists, and then that Universalist half of our heritage started in the 1700s as a rejection of Calvinist predestination, you know, saying that we don't believe that some people are doomed to hell for all eternity, but it increasingly came to be a universal love for all people in this world. So instead of worrying about hell in the next world, it was saying, let's just start with loving the hell out of this world. And that help means both ways, right? That we can create a hell for ourselves on this world. So she writes, "This means being in relationship with the world, and it means constantly expanding who we are. It means challenging ourselves to listen more and to let go of our need to be right all the time or to respond defensively if someone invites you to consider that there might be an angle you're not seeing. It does not mean we will always agree, because we won't. But it means we will stay in conversation without necessarily demanding that the other person agree that we're right. It means staying in conversation because we want to hear more of the other person's story. To be part of a diverse, pluralistic community, seeking to build the beloved community, means that we must continually seek to stay in right relationship with one another across our differences and with compassion. And in regard to constantly expanding what we mean by we and doing that with integrity and right relationship, studying the history of how the meaning of the word disability has changed radically over time can give us hope that the definitions and the perceptions and the experiences of disability can and will continue to become more sensitive and inclusive. To consider just a few historical examples, the United States Constitution, and people get, who sort of fetishize the Constitution, get in trouble sometimes. They'll say, like, let's have a reading of the Constitution, and they forget some of the really terrible things that are in there. It's an amazing document, right, on one hand, and for the most part. But at the same time, the United States Constitution, right there, I think it's like, what, Article 2, Section 2, it's right there at the beginning, says that enslaved people should be counted as 3/5 of a person. That and other racial inferiority myths helped create, in the 19th century and before, this perception of disability to justify slavery as a positive good for a people falsely depicted as lesser than. Similar tropes of disability were used to keep women as second-class citizens. In 1873, for instance, we have records of a respected president at Harvard Medical School, this was published widely, publicly warning against the dangers of these increasing numbers of white women who were seeking higher education. According to his research, higher education could and had, quote, permanently disabled respectable white women. No woman, he warned, could simultaneously use a good brain and a good reproductive system that could serve the race. Now, there's so much wrong with that sentence that we do not have time for it right now. So this is the end of what he said. It's just simply too much for the female body. Oh, Lord, right, I mean, it's just... Wow. That was a Harvard professor less than 150 years ago teaching that women were all women were too intellectually disabled to pursue higher education without permanently, you know, hurting themselves further. So just as African Americans and women had to overcome racist and sexist structures and perceptions in society, Leonard Davis has written a book titled Enabling Acts about the history of how we came to have the Americans with Disabilities Act. He reminds us of what the world was like for many people with disabilities in this country until quite recently, as they faced a society that was structured only for certain bodies. If I had time, or I can show some of you later that are interested, it's also really interesting to go back and look at the Ellis Island records and the way people's bodies were evaluated of whether they would be allowed to immigrate. It's so off the hook. I'll just say it that way. For Davis's parents, who wrote this book, were both deaf. He was born hearing. He writes that when I looked at the life of my parents, this is before the internet, of course, he said there were no telecommunication devices that allowed their family or friends to call them and arrange to meet up. Every visit required that a postcard be sent and another one returned with place, date, and time arranged. They couldn't call a doctor to make an appointment or a travel agent to book a flight. There were no sign language interpreters available for doctor's visits, for hospital stays, even for court dates. They couldn't go to religious services because there were no sign language interpreters, so they couldn't follow what was going on. That remains true here. I'll say more about that later. Movies had no captions. If you had a mobility impairment, you could not use local public transportation. Since automobiles weren't yet especially equipped with hand controls, you were essentially confined to your house. With no curbs or ramps, most streets were impossible to navigate, and most buildings were inaccessible. If you were a person with Down syndrome, autism, other cognitive impairments, unless you had a lot of family money, you would be shipped off to, I do not exaggerate, a nightmarish institution. In some instances, in those institutions, as few as 1 to 3 men were in charge of as many as 350 patients, including those individuals with the most severe disabilities. So essentially, they were just all restrained all the time. And through the first half of the 20th century, we see even prominent figures like President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, hiding and sort of conspiring with the press to hide from the general public that he was paralyzed from the waist down due to polio. The turning point was parents coming out of the closet, so to speak, on behalf of their children. Just as people telling their personal truth has changed the hearts and minds of the majority of the American public about the inherent worth and dignity of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender citizens of this country, so too the starting, probably most famously, with the Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize winning author, Pearl Buck, her 1950 book, The Child Who Never Grew, described Carol, her daughter, who had cognitive disabilities, not as shameful, but as a source, but as innocent and full of joy. Similarly, regarding Rosemary Kennedy, the cognitively disabled sister of President John F. Kennedy, in 1962, Eunice Shriver Kennedy wrote, another Kennedy sister, wrote to the Saturday Evening Post that mental retardation can happen in any family. It has happened in the families of the poor and the rich, of governors and senators, Nobel Prize winners, doctors, lawyers, writers, men of genius, presidents of corporations, the President of the United States. That piece was published a decade before Rawls published his A Theory of Justice, but knowing that disabilities and differences can happen to every family should incline us to work to build a world that is accessible as possible for all. As it became more acceptable to be public about disabilities, a coalition of politicians with personal stakes in disability rights reaching across the partisan divide led to the passage of the ADA. People that would typically never speak or work with one another reached across the partisan aisle to work together because they knew what it was like for people living with disabilities. They included Republican Senator Bob Dole, who spent himself 2 years in bed recovering from injuries in World War II, and one of his arms was permanently injured. You would always see him carrying, or do still see him carrying, a pen. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy always had in mind his older sister Rosemary. Ted Kennedy himself had various physical ailments, as did his brother John. And Ted Kennedy's own son Teddy's treatment for bone cancer at age 12 required that his leg be amputated above the knee. Democratic Senator Tom Harkin, who we talked about earlier, his older brother was born deaf, and Harkin spent his childhood with his sibling, learning sign language in the process. The senator also had a nephew who became a paraplegic in an accident when he was in the U.S. Army. From here in Maryland, Democratic Representative Steny Hoyer's wife was an epileptic, and he was a lot of the meetings happened in his office. He was an incredibly active participant for the ADA. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch's brother-in-law had contracted both forms of polio when he was a college student, and his brother-in-law continued through his education and was incredibly successful, even though he had to be in an iron lung every night. Crucially, as well, President Herbert Walker Bush, again a Republican, was the one who would sign this bill into law. He had an uncle who had polio. One of Bush's brothers had been born with only one eye. Bush's son Neil had severe learning disabilities. Another son, Marvin, also had a colostomy. The president had also lost a daughter, Robin, to leukemia when she was only 4 years old. In some ways, that list both is and isn't surprising, since 20% of Americans are living with disabilities. But together, that coalition of legislators helped make our country a more humane place for all. Among other iconic moments that contributed to the ADA, some of you can remember this headline in the newspaper, perhaps the most unforgettable moment was March 12, 1990, when activists with various mobility impairments crawled with great difficulty up all of the steps to the U.S. Capitol. To draw attention to the need for the Americans with Disabilities Act and to protest Congress's slow pace in considering the legislation. Another vitally important contribution was the agreement among activists from the beginning. So they easily could have been split with infighting, but they agreed from the very beginning of this push that no single group, blind, deaf, mobility impaired, effectively or cognitively disabled, HIV positive, and that particular was controversial at the time. They said, none of us will be thrown under the bus. None of us would be sacrificed. There was either going to be all of us or none of us. It wouldn't just be justice for some of us. As a result, there have been many positive changes in our society in the last 25 years since the passage of the ADA. But the greatest gap in the bill is that the ADA was an anti-discrimination bill, not an employment bill. And that was part of the compromise that was made to get it passed across partisan lines. But tragically, employment numbers have actually worsened in the 25 years since the passage of the ADA. According to the Employment and Disability Institute at Cornell University, 28.4% of disabled adults worked in 1990, compared with 14.4% in 2013. But it doesn't have to be that way. If we look around the world at how we might change these numbers, how other countries have changed those numbers, the most obvious solution, and this is a dirty word in Washington, D.C., that word is quotas, which, although controversial in the U.S., are precisely what has worked in other countries. For example, in France, all companies with more than 20 workers are required to have 6% of their employees be people with disabilities. The average rate of unemployment of European Union workers with disabilities is about 5% of those who want to work. Compare that with 80% of people who want to work in the U.S. The ADA is only the beginning of what is needed. For our part, we here at UUCF are fortunate in many ways to have a building that is 12 years old. Our structure is all on one floor. You know, there are many older congregations that are decades and centuries old that have very narrow stairwells that are, multi-floors. So our building is naturally much more accessible than many other religious structures, and we have both hearing amplification devices, we have large print orders of service, other things along those lines. However, we don't have doors that are easily opened electronically. So if you're in a wheelchair coming by yourself, it can be hard. Our doors are actually pretty heavy. It can be hard to get in the building. And even with the large deaf population in our area, we do not yet have an American Sign Language interpreter. But myself and others are looking into the process for potentially hiring an ASL interpreter for at least one of our services. As we look toward building a more just future, the Unitarian Universalist Association has published a new program called Accessibility and Inclusion Ministries. So similar to our LGBT welcoming program, similar to our Green Sanctuary program, we have a new Accessibility Inclusion Ministry program. So I know Sue Thompson and other UUCF members have already done, even before that program started, done some work on building a proposal for evaluating UUCF and working toward taking the next things that need to be done to make us more accessible. But if you have a particular passion around making UUCF more accessible, or hearing the sermon says, that's something I could do, then please do email me, let me know that you'd like to be part of a potential accessibilities and inclusion ministry team. For now, we began this morning by singing, "Come, come, whoever you are." Invite you to turn in your teal hymnals to the related song 1018, "Come and Go With Me." And as we sing, I invite you to continue to reflect on how you might be called to advocate for disability rights in the various places in which you have influence, so that when we sing songs like "Come, Come, Whoever You Are," or "Come and Go With Me," we might increasingly make it possible not just for some to be able to respond, but for all.